Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today at the Siebel Center on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We're coming to you live for the first time in Media Matters history. Our guest today will be John Nichols, discussing really the best book I've ever read, and the book everyone's trying to buy desperately.
It's a big problem with theft in the stores. Kids are taking it.
But before we go into that book and talk to John Nichols live, we're going to go, as always, to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Google stunned the broadband industry last week with an announcement that it wants to build high-speed fiber networks in a small number of trial locations across the United States. The internet search giant plans to deliver 1 gigabit per second speeds, 100 times faster than what's commonly available in America, to, quote, experiment with new ways to help make internet access better and faster for everyone. Susan Crawford is a law professor at the University of Michigan Law School, where she recently returned after spending a year as a technology and communications advisor to President Barack Obama. Crawford says that Google's announcement was a truly significant moment.
Fiber is the technology of the 21st century, and Google is going to show us how expensive it really is to install fiber for a community that wants it. And the capacity of fiber is extremely high, so we know we're going to need it for 21st century communications, and there's very little of it running to homes in the country right now. So this is important because we'll learn so much about what people can use these very high-capacity communications networks for, how much it costs, and how easy it is for lots of companies to compete sharing this infrastructure.
Google is clear that it doesn't intend to compete with network owners like AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast.
Just by having an experiment with fiber in a few communities, Google can change the landscape of communications policy. We'll have so much more information that the carriers won't be the only holders of that relevant information about communications. And that will make all of us move away from minimum speeds for broadband and towards a brighter fiber future.
And a brighter broadband future could mean a brighter economic picture, Crawford says.
There's a recent UN study showing that internet access is causally related to a percent or more of economic growth in developed nations. That's huge. If we could move from 2% growth to 3% growth in any year, that would change the landscape for Americans. It's a job creator. It's an innovation promoter. It's great for small businesses. So I see very strong links between high-speed internet access and our economic future.
Those interested in trying to bring Google's 1 gigabit fiber network to their communities can learn more at googleblog.blogspot.com.
3 years ago, Stephanie Lenz, a mother of two from Pennsylvania, posted a video of her 18-month-old son dancing around in the kitchen on YouTube. Playing in the background on the radio was the song Let's Go Crazy by Prince. What started as an innocent family home movie turned into a lawsuit that garnered national attention after YouTube issued a takedown notice for the video, claiming that it violated copyright law. Sherwin C., deputy legal director for Public Knowledge, a group that focuses on citizens' rights in digital culture, says this is one extreme example of all the problems with current copyright law today.
There are lawsuits being filed on all sorts of questionable circumstances and takedown notices being sent for things that really should clearly be legal. You have, you know, questions, active questions about whether or not it's actually legal to rip your CD to your iPod, something that certainly doesn't harm the record labels any, and something that everybody generally agrees is certainly morally, unambiguously not a problem. And yet there's questions about whether or not the law allows it.
These issues are particularly urgent today in a world where it is clear that digital is here to stay.
Everything that we do digitally makes a copy, at least certainly in a technical sense. And whether it does or not in the legal sense is something that's completely up for grabs and certainly wasn't really considered when copyright law was being developed centuries ago.
Public Knowledge has stepped forward with a new Copyright Reform Act, model legislation that will look at updating copyright law in five major areas for the digital age, including fair use, reforms to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and changes to music licensing laws to encourage new business models for selling music. C explains that the reforms they are seeking are not radical, but reasonable.
We want to make a few changes to the Copyright Act to bring it more in line with reality. We're not necessarily trying to do something that will start from scratch and say, well, if we wanted to have an ideal system to spur innovation and creativity, what would that look like? What we're hoping to do instead is actually just look at the law we currently have and see where could we tweak it here and there so that we can basically get along and move forward and explore and develop some of the technologies that we have and develop some of the uses that we have so that artists are compensated, so that users don't have this sort of Damocles of infringement hanging over their head.
To learn more about the Copyright Reform Act, go to publicknowledge.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, February 21st, 2010, here in the Siebel Center on the campus of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, our all-time first live program. And our guest today, none other than John Nichols, by far the most frequent guest in the history of Media Matters, virtual co-host at times. And he's usually here shamelessly flogging you for money if you're in the listening audience. Today we're only flogging those in the literal physical audience for money. The listening audience, we're here to discuss our new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, just published by Nation Books, that we've been traveling around talking about, and John and I are going to be talking about it for the next hour. Before we get to that, though, I do want to thank Melissa Trentz and Jay Pierce for their hard work and everyone at WILL for putting this together. Mike Pritchard has come in here on a Sunday, who works tirelessly during the week. It's an extraordinary station that's made this show possible for the last 8 years, and I hope for the next 8 years. And everyone in the listening audience, when we have our big pledge drive on April 11th, circle that date. Make sure to listen and make your pledge then. John will be back with us, of course, for a two-hour marathon session then. But today, no more shameless flogging for money to those of you in the listening audience. We're going to talk about the book. I will say we will be back to our normal non-live audience method of programming. A week from today, we'll have Amy Goodman as our guest talking about what she's been doing at Democracy Now! And today, for the first time and only time in Media Matters history, we will not take callers over the phone. We will have questions, but they'll all come from our studio audience today. And we'll start that in about 15 or 20 minutes. First, though, let me introduce my dear friend John Nichols, who's known to all of you, journalist for The Nation magazine, frequent guest now on The Ed Show on MSNBC and all sorts of other media, and also a daily newspaper editor for the past 25 years, now for the last 15 at the Capital Times newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. John Nichols, welcome to Media Matters.
It's good to be with you. It's also good to be with all these beautiful Illinoisans. They're very attractive people.
Well, that's very kind of you to say.
Yeah, it's striking. It's
coming
striking.
From the state with the biggest rear ends in the country.
Oh, excuse me.
I speak from knowledge.
Yeah. Wow, that's I am you know, I'm on a no Illinois joke
okay,
regimen.
I'm sorry.
Here,
I shouldn't
so
have
let's
gone
just
there.
Be a little cool about
okay,
that.
Okay, I'm sorry. Right? I shouldn't have gone there, John. I apologize. Yeah. Well, John Nichols, The Death and Life of American Journalism.
Yeah.
You know, there was the book, we wrote it and finished it, and it was published a few weeks ago. And just almost the day it came out, the Pew Center, one of the mm-hmm. most well-known research groups in the country that studies public policy and media and news and politics, mm-hmm. issued really what I think would be called a landmark study that frames a lot of the issues we're concerned about and how to think about them. And talk about that for a second, if you would.
Well, when you write a book, the one thing you're really scared of is that you got all this research and you think you got it right. You hope so. You put all the footnotes in and everything like that. But it's always very nice when, at the point of publication, the top research center in the country on the issues you're writing about comes out with something and confirms everything you wrote, which is very, very useful.
Otherwise, we wouldn't mention it.
Yeah. Mind you, we're not that stupid. And the thing that the Pew Center did, it's the kind of research that we'll see more of in coming years. research based in fear, frankly, and in horror at what's occurring. Obviously, the point of our book is to argue that American journalism as we've known it as a commercial entity is collapsing, and that the dream of a replacement for it on the internet is not even beginning to unfold. There's not a filling of the void there. And so then there are great dangers for democracy that come in that moment. Pew telescoped all that discussion into the city of Baltimore, Maryland, which is a classic American city. It has a great big daily newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, which once upon a time arguably competed with some of the biggest and most powerful dailies in the country. Baltimore Sun, when I started in journalism, had a dozen foreign bureaus. It had people covering every continent and really was a player. Today, the Baltimore Sun has no foreign bureaus, and this is true of virtually all of our major dailies. The transition that has occurred has been a radical downsizing. But they have this big daily, which has always been the source of most news. Then they also have a bunch of radio stations, as any urban center does, the network TV stations, the local cable news information channels. They have a lot of very active blogosphere. It's the home of Johns Hopkins. And so they have blogs, news websites, and the Pew people studied all of this. They also, to be so liberal in their definition of where original news might come from, because that's what they were trying to find out. They were trying to figure out where people were getting their news, how it was generating. They even studied Twitter feeds from the police department with the purpose, because the police department would send out Twitter tweets on who had just been arrested. So they even studied that as original news. Did this whole look. And here's what they found. First off, the Baltimore Sun was still the primary source of information in the community, the daily newspaper, and that's true in most communities. The daily newspaper newsroom is a big operation with a lot of people that go out. And it was still the primary source of information, but the Baltimore Sun was producing 33% fewer news stories than it did 10 years ago and 73% fewer news stories than it did 20 years ago. So your primary source of information really not producing nearly as much, not doing as much news. So the question is, well, is new media filling the void? So they studied all the old, so-called old media, newspaper, radio, television versus all new media. And they came up with a number that tells you how much new media is filling the void. 4%. 96% of the original news in the community still coming from what would be described as old media. Only 4% being produced by blogs, online news sites, all the bells and whistles stuff that we hear a lot of noise about, but that doesn't have the resources. It's not that people who are blogging aren't great folks. I've been a blogger since 1999, and I love it. I think the future is digital. It's just that without the resources, that void is not being filled. So remember your figures there. 73% drop in production of news by old media. New media not filling the void. And then here's the critical number. Pew looked at, well, where is the news coming from? Who's packaging the news? And what we know very simply is that there's really two ways that news circulates in a modern society. One way is if a journalist goes out and asks questions, digs up information, maybe challenges those in power, what we say speaks truth to power. Or, secondly, if power manages the news, if it shapes its information and then someone, you know, playing the game of journalism, pretending to be a journalist, does stenography to power. Think of all the coverage of George Bush. And so you end up in this situation where it's coming from one way or the other. In Baltimore, the figure they came up with was 86% of the so-called original news stories that they studied came from power, came from somebody with public relations operations trying to shape or narrow the debate. Only 14% coming from the people. And as we say in the book, we think that's the dangerous future we face.
And just to follow up on that, John Nichols, talk a little bit about the rise of public relations relative to journalism. That's some of the original research in the
book.
It
is. And it's the thing that excites us. You know, when you write a book, you get a chance to pause and take a look at all the new information, studies by other great scholars and researchers, and also to do a little bit of original work yourself and work with graduate students and others.
Exploit them, let's be
fair. Yeah, exploit graduate students, which I think we're on a university campus. That's an accepted concept. And so what we did was we wanted to quantify at this time when we are losing journalists at such a dramatic rate, and remember that Right now, for the last 2 years, every month, daily newspapers in America lay off more than 1,000 employees. More than 1,000 employees a month at newspapers are losing jobs. I think, well, what's happening? If those people aren't going out and gathering information, reporting it, who is managing our information? And what we found was, in looking at the rise of public relations, gathering information from a lot of different sources, established that in 1960, in the United States, when John Kennedy and Richard Nixon were running against each other for president, we had a 1-to-1 ratio of public relations people to journalists. One public relations person for every one journalist. In 1980, 20 years later, when Ronald Reagan, the person some of us even remember, was running for president, in 1980, it had changed a little bit from 1.2 public relations people to every one journalist, 1.2 to 1. Today, the ratio is 4 public relations people for every one journalist. And what we argue in the book is that this is the really scary thought, that we're not going to have a future that has no information. But if journalism continues to disappear from the stage, we will have a future where information is packaged universally and almost solely in many communities for the purpose of advancing the interests of those who have the resources to hire public relations agents and to control and design the discourse to serve them rather than in any sense to serve a civic or democratic end.
That was John Nichols. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. This is our first live studio version of the show. So if you're listening at home or in your car or wherever, please don't try to call in today. The questions today are going to come from the studio audience on this one-time special occasion to see how this flies. John Nichols, before we go to the questioners here in the studio, a couple more questions we should clear up. When we wrote this book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, we've been out selling it and talking about it. A lot of people are concerned. They think that, well, concern might be the right word. A lot of people say, well, the internet still needs time. Mm-hmm. That I've got a great idea. There's so much talent out there. You know, it took time for radio and television to adapt. It's just a matter of time until someone figures out how to make a lot of money doing journalism on the internet. Then we'll have all the resources we need and all the journalism we could possibly need. What do you say to that?
Well, we spent a lot of time on that issue in writing the book. And look, Bob and I both live. You, Bob, and I both live.
This is very weird.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. I have to be honest. We were talking to this exquisite, you know, very attentive studio audience here.
Yeah.
And so at some point you
John wanted me to use a southern accent, so it would do a different persona.
Yeah, bridge the gap between new media and human beings and all this stuff. It's otherworldly. But one of the things that we tried to do in the book was to make a case for a new media, because we know it's the future. There's simply no question that as newspapers decline, as radio and television news decline, we wanted to find something hopeful out in the the vast network of tubes that is the internet, to quote Senator Stevens. And so we really did a lot of research. We talked to conservative bloggers, conservative news sites, looked at the Drudge Report extensively, all the history of it, looked at Huffington Post and TPM and all sorts of folks. Ones that are funded by foundations like ProPublica, local sites like Voice of San Diego, which has gotten a lot of talk, looked everywhere we could and really spent an immense amount of time trying to figure out, is there life here? Can we make something here? And what we found, invariably, it was this very interesting thing. We'd have people who would say to us, oh, yeah, we've got great ideas. We're probably just around the corner from making money and hiring journalists and doing something. We're not just going to be aggregating old media news stories forever. We're going to be doing our own soon. And then when the interview was getting finished, they would say, because they know Bob and I work in this area a lot, they'd often say, by the way, do you know any way we could make money? Because it's a nightmarish scenario out there. To give you an example, in June of, right as we were finishing the book, I went to Oslo to speak at the United Nations 60th anniversary of the freedom of expression commitments in their charter. And it was a wondrous event where you were meeting with journalists and communicators from all over the world. And I had a chance to spend time. Well, first off, I should tell people why I was invited. I thought I was invited as this great expert, you know, honorable person, all that stuff like that. I found out I was invited, like, the person from the developing country where things are really bad, and I was supposed to tell them how about America, because they wanted to avoid the nightmarish scenario of the decline of journalism in America. And it's important to remember that what's happening here is much worse than in most other countries around the world. So I'm there, but I was talking to the guy who was the editor of the Guardian newspaper in London. And anybody who knows the Guardian knows that they maintain what's generally thought of as the best newspaper news online site in the world. In fact, they get more traffic many days from America than they do from Britain, because it's so impressive. And it's the number two most visited English language news website in the world, just after the New York Times. And when the New York Times puts its paywalls in, it will be number one. And so I said to the guy from The Guardian, "You guys are so great. You're so cool. You must be raking in the dough." And he said, "Well, actually, last year we lost £30 million doing journalism online. Now, we're owned by a trust, so we can keep doing that for a while." And I said, "Well, you must have some sort of plan to start making money online." He says, "Oh, yeah, we have a new plan every year for how to start making money online. We hire the top experts in the world, literally. We've had people from all over the world come to study it, to come up with plans, to come up with approaches. And every year they have a plan, we implement, we do everything we're supposed to and more, and then we lose another £30 million. And he said, "I came up with an idea a year or so ago." Said, "I'm never going to hire anybody who says they know what to do to make money online anymore, because the fact of the matter is, if they tell you they do, they're lying."
John Nichols, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're discussing the new book that I wrote with John, The Death and Life of American Journalism, just out with Nation Books and available, we hope, in fine bookstores everywhere except in the airport we're in, which is not yet available there. We're going to take questions from people in the studio audience here at the Siebel Center if they'd like, and we have mics in the front and on the side. We'll probably start in about 5 or 10 minutes. A couple other issues I want to clear up with John before we go to the audience. John, a lot of people will also say, you know, you give this great critique of the collapse of journalism. You prove pretty much that the market won't solve it online. There's not enough.
I have an excellent co-writer. I don't want to take full credit for proving it.
Yeah. Well, that's very kind of you. But isn't it the American way that the private enterprise generates journalism? And if they can't do it, well, you're just out of luck. I mean, just, you know, roll up the carpet. If that's how America works. It's the American way. The freedom of the press means the private market is in charge of giving you journalism, and that competition will generate the journalism you need, want, and deserve. If the market decides journalism isn't necessary anymore, then that means the people of this country decided they no longer want democracy, and that's just the way it should be. Isn't that
quite like that?
Is that a rhetorical question?
It's sort of it was extremely rhetorical.
Or loaded,
Mr. University professor guy. And you know, the interesting thing is that what you just said, Bob, is actually, you know, you say it sort of with the little last comic line on it, but it is essentially the accepted notion.
That's what we're asked at every talk, more or less. Yeah. That's why I put it in those terms.
Well, and what's intriguing about it is that there are few industries, and the commercial news media is certainly an industry, that have done a better job of convincing Americans of a certain concept of how things should be than the news media. Now, that makes sense. They communicate with all of us, and so it's a logical thing. And what's essentially communicated is this, that the only way you can get good media is if the people who own the media make a lot of money doing it. That this is the logical construct, and any other way of doing it will invariably lead you to a totalitarian state. Because if Rupert Murdoch is not getting super rich all the time, and somebody else getting rich too, GE or somebody like that, then somehow the whole thing won't work, because news cannot exist without billionaires. They're the essential element. But the problem with that construct is that it's a new construct built in the age of advertising and commercial media in the last 150 years or so of the United States.
Max.
And when you understand that we now are in a moment where all the evidence suggests that the commercial media system as it existed, advertising sustained journalism. Remember, they take in these billions of dollars and they throw a little to journalism. You know, most of it goes to the investors. That's nothing crazy here, nothing that would upset Milton Friedman. Rich get richer, but the poor get a little bit of news. And that system was how it worked for a very long time. May not have created great news, but there was certainly a lot of news. And so this notion became so implanted that people really did think. In fact, I think we might even count ourselves in the camp that if you had any other way of doing it, then invariably, you might as well start open up a discussion of Stalin and Pol Pot and, you know, the worst possible notions for how you would structure a society, right? You know, government control, sort of North Korea on steroids. And what we found in doing the research for the book, and this is based on terrific research by many other scholars who've kind of blazed into this territory, is that in America, for the first 100 years, before we had a commercial system, we had a system to sustain journalism. And in fact, in the period when we were shaping the American experiment, when we made it what it is, we had a system for sustaining journalism. It was government, postal, and printing subsidies. And those subsidies spawned the richest and most diverse competitive and dissenting media in the world at its time. Far from having to enrich billionaires, what we did in this country without a government overlay, without totalitarianism, simply saying, if you want to publish a newspaper and you can, you know, meet some baseline, the simplest of basic standards, you can do it, and the government will make it easy for you to do so because it is so very vital that the people of this new democracy have information. Now, we could go into great detail on this, but the basic thing that people have to understand is the way in which Jefferson and Madison and the other founders of the Republic understood the free press protection. We have an addendum in the book where we go through dozens of quotes from the founders on this issue because many of our conservative friends like to suggest that we should always rely on original intent. What did the founders really think of how we should understand our constitutional protections? Well, this is one we know. We have more original intent on this, arguably, than anything else. And what it tells us is the founders believed that the freedom of the press protection in the First Amendment was absolutely vital, and that it meant two things. First, the one we always know, that a journalist should never be censored. The government should never tell you what to write, what perspective to have, and also that anybody who wants to start a newspaper or a radio station or a television station or a blog or an online news site should be able to do so, that there should be no barrier to entry into this discourse. So all the freedom, all the concepts that we've always had about what freedom of the press is. But the other thing they understood is that promise in isolation is a hollow right. It means nothing if you don't have a free press. The basic way to understand it is that if I wasn't here today doing this radio show, I could theoretically be at the Olympics in Vancouver winning the gold medal for downhill skiing if I was a good skier. But I'm not. So I have that promise. I have the right to win the gold medal at the Olympics. Nothing will stop me except the fact that it's impossible. It doesn't exist. Well, what I would argue is that the founders knew this. In fact, I don't argue it. The founders themselves did. They knew that a hollow right, a promise without reality, was far more dangerous than the lack of the promise. People would revolt if they were told they couldn't have freedom of the press, that they couldn't say what they wanted. But you wanted something more. You wanted the reality of this free press, and they spawned it. They built it. And what's exciting about reading the history of this republic is to understand how well it worked. And we have a measure in the book. We write it at great length about the people who were the most passionate advocates for the postal subsidies and the printing subsidies. And these were the abolitionist newspaper editors, people who had come, sometimes freed slaves, who the first government money that ever went to a freed slave, the first government support that would ever go to a freed slave, was the postal subsidy and the printing subsidy as they started publication like Freedom's Journal. People here in Illinois, some of the great, bold abolitionist editors who survived because of that postal subsidy and, in some cases, those printing subsidies. Because let's be honest, you can't think about this. Who's going to go out and get an IPO and say, you know, I want to get some investment to start me a abolitionist newspaper. It wasn't going to happen. There was no way that was going to happen. And its advertisers weren't going to support it. The fact is, this was a radical dissenting idea. For the first 70 years of the American experiment, the Congress of the United States was barred from debating slavery. They thought it was too intense. It's an issue you put aside, like, I guess, health care. And so they weren't going to have an honest debate on slavery. And the presidential candidates would not have an honest debate on slavery. And yet, thanks, in a very real sense, and you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin, all the books, all that Walt Whitman writes about it, all the writers of the time recognize this. Thanks to those government subsidies, the most radical and dissenting editors and thinkers in America were able to spread their ideas. And as it's very interesting that as the subsidies were increased for the abolitionist press, when we removed the barriers to circulation for some of the smallest of the abolitionist papers around 1840s, was when we saw the explosion of abolitionist activism in America. And this is true of other social movements as well. The bottom line, this country spawned a dissenting press that challenged its original sin. So far from being totalitarian, government subsidies can actually make a country do the right thing.
And just to add to that, the same subsidies that supported the abolitionist press supported all the press that was in favor of slavery. It was an equal standard as long as anyone met it all qualified.
And it's just, Bob, this is where I get to throw a question in. Because there's a danger here of when we talk about this wonderful American history, it becomes one of those moments where people say, wow, that is so great. I sort of love my country more than I ever thought I would. But this is not just ancient history. And that's something that we deal with a lot in the book. And
our guest, John Nichols. I'm Bob McChesney. We're talking about our new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism. We're coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 before a live studio audience in the Siebel Center. We've got another half hour or so before we have to wrap up here. We aren't taking callers today, so please don't call in. All the questions are going to come from our studio audience, and we're going to start right now. We have a gentleman already queued up. Why don't you tell folks your name and then give your question, please?
My name is Martin Brussel. So I have a couple of things on my mind here. For new mechanisms for promoting journalism, there's a station like Democracy Now, which is supported by subscribers. Now, you also haven't mentioned the fact that periodicals have taken up some of the duties of journalism, especially not local journalism, but national and international journalism. So I'd just like you to comment on whether there's a possibility of subscriber-maintained journalism. We know that even in England, BBC followed, in general, the government's policy. So there is always that tension and conflict when the government supports journalism. So I'd just like you to comment on that.
Great question. Thank you very much. And I'll take a crack at that one. We go through in the book all sorts of different mechanisms to support journalism in addition to advertising, including subscribers, in the commercial or in the case of an Amy Goodman Democracy Now! Non-commercial environment, also foundations and funders. And in the best case scenario, if all those come through, we're still going to be way short of what we need in terms of resources. That's really the point we make in the book. We encourage all those things. We want to encourage them more, but we just can't have any illusions about them being satisfactory. I'd also say that there's, going back to sort of the dystopian future if we do nothing, two other things about the traditional commercial system we should be concerned with if we do nothing else with government subsidies to spawn a broader journalism. During the era of advertising dominating journalism, what you had was a situation where there were only a handful of news media in a community, and advertisers didn't have a great deal of leverage. They had some leverage. They didn't like the coverage. They'd go somewhere else, but not a great deal. So it gave the newsroom a certain amount of autonomy, a certain amount of freedom of operation. It didn't have to worry if it covers something that advertisers didn't like, they'd remove all their ads. That would happen sometimes, but a certain amount of leverage. In the new internet era, that leverage is disappearing. Now you've got 1,000 websites trying to shake down an ad from the same advertiser. They've got all the leverage on their side now, which is really driving a lot of bloggers nuts, that traditional respect for the sanctity of editorial versus commercial, the Chinese walls, they used to call it in journalism, it just can't withstand this competitive pressure. Advertisers have all the chips in their number. All the balls are in their court. The second issue is that, you know, one of the great crises of commercial journalism in the last 30 years is it's basically, for commercial reasons, our news media, and regrettably this even applies to non-commercial media associated with NPR and PBS at times, is that it has lost its commitment to covering the entirety of our communities, that poor people increasingly only matter when they get in the way of rich people. You know, you can go to Detroit today, and you, as John likes to talk about, you can't even find a Detroit daily newspaper within the city limits of Detroit because the advertisers aren't interested in the people who live in Detroit, just in the suburbs of Detroit. And if we go to an HBO-style system, a subscription system as the economic basis, well, we're just reifying, to use a fancy term, you know, making permanent a system where we'll have a journalism pitched at a certain class of people and avoid large chunks of other people. That whole notion, that vision of a journalism that has one set of truths and ideas for some people and a significant part of the population is written out of the picture entirely, I think must be anathema to anyone who cares about self-government or democracy. It certainly was anathema to their everlasting credit to the founders and to the policies like the postal and printing subsidies they put into place. They didn't see that. And here I'm going to go off on a little bit of a bender. Before we go back to our next question.
I'll try and reel you back.
Yeah, reel me back. One of the things that John and I wanted to do, now Jefferson and Madison are imperfect people. We've criticized them. And the whole fact that we're talking about the abolitionists talks about their great original crime they have to deal with, and they have their imperfections. But one of the things John and I wanted to do is understand why were Jefferson and Madison so singularly obsessed with creating a press system that would be viable. And Jefferson's most famous essay came in 1787 in a letter he wrote to Edward Carrington. And this is a letter that oftentimes is quoted. In fact, when I used to work at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer building in Seattle, it was the big saying right over the door as you walked into the PI building was Jefferson's quote, if he could have a choice of a government without newspapers or newspapers without government, he'd obviously take the latter. And everyone likes that. But I read the entire essay in which that quote appears, and it's taken out of context. And it's a very striking essay because in the essay, Jefferson says, if you don't have credible journalism, in the United States, a system to inform the great mass of people, you will become like Europe. And Europe is a place where the wolves devour the sheep, the rich devour the poor. And with journalism, a press system is the only protection people without property have to protect them from wealthy people taking over the governance, even in an ostensible democracy. That will always happen, barring a credible press system that draws people without property into public life. He said it baldly. He couldn't have been more direct about it. And, I mean, he hit the ball right over the fence. That's what we're facing today. We're going to have manufactured PR-driven news for the most of us, and people in power are going to get really good news they're going to pay for, and it's going to be first-rate stuff, and they're going to run the world, and we won't have a clue. We're going to be talking about John Edwards' wingman and whatever nonsense they're throwing at us to keep us occupied. Tiger Woods' earth-shattering press conference, which usurped television all day Fridays we were traveling.
I'm going to defend Tiger Woods, though, because unlike so many people who find Christianity when they get in trouble, he found Buddhism.
No,
I thought that was cool.
That's really impressive. That was John Nichols offering his keen insights on the news of the day. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. This is our first studio program at the Siebel Center here on the campus of the University of Illinois. We've got another 20, 25 minutes. We're discussing our brand new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, which has just come out. And I think we have another person with a question. Please give your name and your question.
My name is Jane Heaton. Mm-hmm. And my question is, I understand you must be talking about subsidies mm-hmm. to support journalism. How would that work, especially with the new types of media we have, sure. and in this era of budget cuts, how's that going to fly?
That's a great question, Jane.
Do you want to split that in half and one of us do the politics and one of us do some of the proposals?
Let me do some politics.
Now, I'll start with some proposals.
I cover politics for a living.
You want to do the politics first, or maybe throw some proposals out, and then you can talk about what happened in Washington last week?
No, I'm going to do the. Let me do politics and tell you the basic politics. Then you
we
can
go
do
through
proposals
this all the time.
And
he always wants to talk first.
No. I'm good to go either way. But I think because that is the question we've gotten everywhere we've gone, and Bob will explain some of the proposals here a little bit and give a sense of it. But this is the real crisis in America today. We've got everybody convinced that nothing good can happen, right? That we're at the moment where it's just completely dysfunctional as a republic, and there are no possibilities of even beginning to address problems. And that, of course, for power is the dream scenario, right? That we just know we can't fix anything. And what I want to emphasize, that the way to think about this debate and the way to think about subsidies broadly is that we use the term very, very liberally. We take a lot of things that not everybody would even describe as a subsidy, because it's really our shorthand term for the government getting engaged, driven by the people demanding a media system that works for them. And so this isn't, you know, some sort of situation where you would necessarily have the government giving Rupert Murdoch money. In fact, we're radically opposed to bailing out the people that drove journalism off the cliff. We don't want to give old media that did a rotten job more resources. But what we do want is for people who've heard what we're talking about and who've joined in this discussion and who get concerned, who get passionate, to recognize that this is an issue they can be engaged with, that they can demand interventions and actions that serve a democracy, that make sure that we have a small d democratic discourse. If people understand that, we're going to come up with millions of different ideas, right? Some of them really good and some of them really lousy. But it's that discourse, that sense that it's an issue, something we can get engaged with, that matters. And what we will emphasize is nothing we are talking about, the most wildest proposals that we would make, where we just everything we could possibly ask for, wouldn't amount to more than 10, 12 weeks in Iraq or, you know, 3-4% of the first bank bailout. And so we tell you that up front because people need to understand we're not talking about some sort of massive new thing. What we're really talking about is a freeing up of the people to actually produce good journalism, of journalists to produce good journalism without some of those commercial constraints, with the idea, ultimately, that with that 3-4% of the first bank bailout, or with that 10 or 12 weeks of what it cost to occupy Iraq, we might be able to avoid the next Iraq or the next bailout. We think it's a very small investment, and Bob will tell you about a couple of the notions that we're throwing.
Yeah, I mean, in the book we come up with a few sort of shorthand, quick things that are quasi-shovel ready we could do immediately to stop the bleeding. Because the crisis is such, we can't really wait 20 years and appoint a task force to come up with a solution when there's nothing left. That's not an option if we're going to remain a republic. That's simply not possible. And we also come up with some longer-term ideas that really try to rethink the entire way journalism is structured in the digital world, which is the world we're rapidly moving into. Shovel-ready things right away. The United States spends... if we increase tenfold the federal support of public, community, and student media in the United States, tenfold increase, we'd still be at a per capita level one half of what Canada pays per capita. So we could have a massive increase, and we still have one half what Canada pays. And in Europe, if you go to Germany or Denmark or Sweden or Finland or Norway or the Netherlands or Britain, when you mention Canada, they start laughing. They don't even think Canada has public broadcasting. That's how little Canada pays per capita relative to Japan or any of those countries that is named in Europe. So we could increase our per capita spending in public broadcasting 30, 40, 50-fold, and then we'd start getting up to the levels of those nations I just named in Europe. That's one place to start, especially at the local level. I don't have to tell people in Champaign-Urbana this, but listeners, wherever you're listening to this program in the United States, local areas have been decimated in the last 10 years. There's just very few journalists covering local politics anymore, and it's not going to happen if we sit around and wait for the market or some philanthropist to bail us out. Let's get some money into both public and community stations and into student stations. We never thought it was sufficient to have a monopolistic commercial system in the community, nor should we have a monopolistic non-commercial system. We can have non-commercial competition between well-funded newsrooms. That's an immediate thing. A second thing, John and I like to talk about that's, I think, well received, especially at colleges, is that we're about to lose an entire generation of young people that want to be journalists that aren't going to be able to find employment. They're going to go, if they're lucky, into public relations, and if they're unlucky, into some other field altogether. This is
the law.
The law. That's what we need, more lawyers. That's one thing where we have a comparative advantage. And, you know, this is not an acceptable outcome. I think we have to create some sort of Write for America, News AmeriCorps, pick your title. We need to somehow get this generation 1 or 2 years, pay them to go out and start covering this community, working for local TV and radio stations. We prefer to do it for nonprofit, non-commercials. We don't want to use them as a wedge to break union jobs at other news media. But somehow intelligently do with journalists so we get 10 or 20,000 kids, and I'm old enough to use that term, working, getting paid, and forcing us to make sure that we keep journalism alive in healthy institutions. Then third, we go through a lot of this in the book, but there's one important issue. We do have to think in terms of how are we going to have journalism down the road in a primarily digital world, what we're in the 5, 10, 15, 20-year process of completing. And, you know, we have some discussions in the book of long-term funding strategies, and the one that we really like, that's we were surprised when we were in Washington this week meeting with people who are studying journalism for the government, that they gravitated to this, the most radical idea we had in our book, we thought, which was that ultimately we need to have a news media system that embraces the internet, doesn't try to put paywalls and electronic barbed wire all over it, make it difficult for people to use the internet and have to use passwords and credit cards every time you go from one site to another. But we also have to have paid journalism, to have competing independent newsrooms. So how do we do that? Well, why don't we pay the journalist up front with a public subsidy, but not have the government control who gets the money? Let every individual have a libertarian citizen's news voucher of $200. They can pick any news medium of their choice to give it to. And it's their choice. If they don't want to do it, the government just keeps the $200, but you can allocate $200. And it would be competitive because the people that would fight for it, there'd be fraud prevention, so you couldn't have people scam money off of it. It's not that hard to do, actually. And then it'd be very competitive. So if you don't like the news coverage you're getting in your community, you can start one of these and go out and get people in your community to bankroll it. If you do a good job, you get more money, you hire more journalists. It's a massive public subsidy to give the resources to do journalism without government saying who gets it, and recognizing that the internet will not do it otherwise, and also recognizing in exchange for getting the subsidy, everything that's produced goes online for free in the public domain. So you're creating this huge bounty everyone has instant access to at no charge. And one last point, because we should go back to our next question. We've been waiting patiently. But John and I thought, like many of you probably are thinking now, before we went to Washington last week, that this is really way off in the future. This stuff is crazy talk. Who would ever think of doing stuff like this in America? That's just unthinkable. And I can see someone's thinking this already. People think, are you guys insane?
And seriously, well, I think actually thinking, are you insane?
He was looking at you.
Oh.
And, you know, what we went to Washington, what we realized is that there's the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, and Congress have all been studying this problem for the last year because they can see what's happening. And initially, all the focus was, well, is there anything government can do? Will the internet set us free? How can we create a new business model that works? We went back this last week. It was pretty clear they all said, basically, you guys are right, in effect. There is no business model that's going to work. The internet isn't going to set us free. If we're going to have journalism, we're going to have to come up with sane public subsidies to protect our core values. Otherwise, it isn't going to happen.
Final thing I just throw on there, too, is they also all said, because they're in Washington, but does anybody in America care about this?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really very true. And so we had this Jane asked this very good question. She said, you know, is this possible in Washington? And so we see the disconnect here, that out in America, everybody's like, could you possibly get anybody in Washington to do the right thing on this? And then you go to Washington, you talk to members of Congress, members of the FCC, members of the Federal Trade Commission, people with real power, and they say, well, we might be able to do something, but does anybody in America really care? And so the real work that needs to be done now, so very seriously, is a connection, and something that doesn't happen very often, a connection of America's genuine concern about the loss of news and potentially the loss of democracy that goes with that, to a Washington that, if pushed on this, we think could actually do some decent things. Let's take this young person's question here.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Carroll from beautiful Urbana, Illinois.
Oh, thank you for being here.
And I'm wondering to what extent it's true that people actually want to get their news online. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't, even though I consider myself fairly technologically savvy. Yet I notice even quality news organizations such as WILL and the PBS NewsHour are putting more and more resources into their websites. And the NewsHour in particular, you notice that their show itself, mm-hmm. the structure of their show is becoming more like a website mm-hmm. with shorter stories for mm-hmm. shorter attention spans, etc. So what degree is it true that, you know, the consumer is demanding this, or is this just kind of a top-down manufactured thing?
That's a fabulous question from someone who, and I'm not going to cast any aspersions or compliments to you one way or the other, but who looks like the classic person who says, I get all my news online, I live, you know what I mean? There's this assumption that younger people are, you know, have already completely given up on all old media, right? And one of the things that we found fascinating is that as you actually go around America, you find that there's a lot of people who push back on that notion. And so you ask yourself, well, where did this happen? Why is there this assumption, especially that young people don't want to have long news stories, don't want information about, you know, their civic and democratic life. They just want more Britney Spears, right? You know, and that notion is alive in the newsrooms of America. Like every consultant who ever talks to a TV station or a radio station or a newspaper about how to reach young people, and they've done so well at it, I might add, how to do it, says, oh, you got to be more entertainment, more, you know,
short stories.
Short stories. You dumb it down as much as possible. And the fact is that if you really study what's going on, you realize these are not audience demand-based decisions. These are commercial decisions, right? Because if you do a lot of entertainment fluff on a show, how do you do entertainment fluff? It's cheap. It doesn't cost anything, right? You just put a camera in front of Britney Spears' house, and if she comes out, you know, you got a picture, and that's it. You know, doing journalism costs money. And what we have found in every medium, online, old media, TV, radio, newspaper, blogosphere, it's like that there's this huge pressure to cut costs because they can't find where the resources are going to come from. And so at the end of the day, they say, well, the best way to cut costs is to go dumber, shorter, more, you know, bells and whistles and fluff than anything with content. But we just don't find the evidence anywhere that there's this huge number of Americans saying, you know, our grandparents were pretty smart, and our parents were pretty smart. We would like to be dumb. We would like to be disengaged and kind of left at the sidelines. And in fact, this is how stupid. You want to find the really dumb people? They're running our news, our TV networks, our radio networks, our big newspapers. Because before the 2008 campaign, the absolute one thing they would tell you is young people would never be interested in politics. It would never, ever happen. No way. No way. And then we had 2008, and suddenly young people were very interested in politics. The baristas at my coffee shop wanted to know how superdelegates were chosen. Well, then they're suddenly all going, oh, wow. You know, and what did you notice they did? The most market-driven operations, the cable channels, suddenly MSNBC becomes the place for politics, and CNN is the place for politics. You know, they all shift over. Audience demand actually is for more news. They just aren't willing to believe it unless it actually hits them right in the face.
That was John Nichols. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. We've only got a few minutes left for another questioner or two, we hope. We're discussing the new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, just published by Nation Books, by John Nichols and Bob McChesney. And just to give some sense how cool John and I are, my 14-year-old daughter, listening to this program online, texted me to say, that's a fabulous question. Mocking you, John Nichols, for saying it was a fabulous question.
She didn't think it was a fabulous question.
She just thought you used that term 14 times already for the last
hour. I'm impressed with the Illinois crowd.
She mocks me, too.
Being a Wisconsinite, I had no idea we would find this intellectual reservoir.
Fabulous
in Illinois.
People. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. On that note, Belden Fields is ready to ask us a question. Professor Fields, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. I don't know if this will be a fabulous question, though. You haven't said anything about the independent media movement in the United States. And it occurs to me that when you're talking about public broadcasting, at least as it's structured now, it's very, very politically vulnerable. Mm-hmm. I think you noticed, everybody who's paid attention to public broadcast, is yes, we do get some of the more dissenting voice, Public Policy Institute, so on, after the Obama election, you know, became more feasible to do that. But you weren't seeing anything like that breadth while Bush was in office, which to me suggests that perhaps if we could get the funding to local areas of the substitute, things like the independent media centers here, where we have a low-power FM station, where we have a print newspaper, where we have the web that we're working on. And these things were already started. You know, it's not that people don't have a place to come to that's already functioning. Do you think that more emphasis should be placed on this, or do you think there just isn't the potential, the national potential, for independent media to have the kind of effect you'd like to see?
That's a great question.
It's a fabulous question.
Fabulous, that's right.
I really am so happy that it was a fabulous question.
You made the mark, yeah.
Our book, in fact, talks a lot about that. I mean, our vision of news media for this country is we don't want to do anything to curtail private commercial news media, or anyone wants to set up a private commercial news media. In fact, the research in our book shows, and it's quite striking, as John said before the show, we did some earlier comments before we went on air, that those countries with the largest subsidies of public and community broadcasting and of creating diverse voices and communities also have the most vibrant and least censored private news media in the world. They're complementary. But our vision for the future, and where the public subsidy should go, should be spawning independent, non-commercial, and nonprofit media. That's where the lion's share, not necessarily all of it, but the lion's share should be going. And I think if you look specifically at public radio and public television, you know, the way the United States does it is very unique to the United States. There's not necessarily a perfect way to do it, but we can learn a great deal from other nations, the Netherlands, Germany, Norway, Sweden, Britain, Canada, for how to do it. And what we find in a lot of those nations is they structurally set it up with a much greater firewall, much more political independence. And parties in power and parties out of power, all politicians get a much more hard grilling than they do in the United States. And I think the other way you do that, besides restructuring our public broadcasting, is you want to have competing voices. We're big believers in diversity and pluralism when it comes to having newsrooms and journalism. And so if we had a well-funded community station and public station, and then using some of that mechanism I talked about, the $200 vouchers, that could fund like an indie news site in town, for example.
Let me just add, that this town has one. I mean, I don't want to rain on the parade. Anyway, this town actually has probably one of the best in the country. And so to recreate that in other places,
Indie media,
I apologize, is so good here compared to so many other places.
Like everywhere else.
The lack of resources is a real issue. And our friend, we have a friend, Joel Rogers, who's a great thinker and sociologist, who has a wonderful line that's best way to think about this. He says, hungry people fighting over food don't usually make real sound decisions. They're desperate, they want to survive, and they want, you know, they hope to just get through to the next day. That's really what we've done to public broadcasting in this country. We have created a hungry people fighting over food situation. The freeing up of what really is minimal amounts of additional resources, I think, could give us far better journalism there, and as we spread it out to indie media and all sorts of other places, we have a potential in the 21st century to have incredibly better journalism and an incredibly more robust democracy.
And to echo that, Belden, with your question, I think the local level is absolutely foundational. That's where it starts. The United States has lost its local edge in journalism, and our whole governing system doesn't survive, as recent elections in this state for lieutenant governor demonstrate. You don't have journalism covering local politics at all, which is where we are now in the United States and in Illinois. On that note, I want to thank you all for joining us today at Media Matters. I want to thank John Nichols for being here.
Thank you very much.
For the first live performance. I want to thank Melissa Trentz, the producer, Mike Pritchard for engineering, Kyle Kroha over across the street in Campbell Hall, and everyone for coming here, and everyone at WILL. See you 1 week from today with Amy Goodman.
Illinois rocks.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, rain today with a high of 38. Tonight, rain continues with a low of 35. Monday morning, rain or snow is likely in the morning with little or no accumulation. The high, 35 degrees. Monday night, cloudy with a low of 26. And Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a high of 37. This is Illinois Public Media WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. Yeah.